Welcome to the show. So nice to be back. Episode 100, a milestone, season 6, and this lovely fall weather. Nice to be back at what I consider the new year for a new season of the Roundtable. My guest this week has roots in one of Manitoba's oldest Métis settlements, St. Francis Xavier, located 15 miles west of Winnipeg, on the banks of the Assiniboine River. By his own account, the history of Manitoba is infused in his blood. Born at the forks of the Red and Assiniboine Rivers in St. Boniface, he spent his formative years in Winnipeg. In the 1970s, he worked for the Children's Aid Society of Winnipeg, what he now characterizes as one of the most oppressive of all children's aid societies. His mother was a housekeeper at the Fort Garry Hotel, her dream job, and his father was a construction worker. From them, he learned the value of hard work, something he's honored in a long professional career, which this week officially came to the end of a chapter, and also the beginning of a new chapter, and we'll talk about that. Ken Richard is a founder of Native Child and Family Services of Toronto, and the agency's first executive director going back to the mid-1980s. He has spent much of his life working to improve the lives of Indigenous children and families. In recent years, he's become an expert witness to the courts and to parliamentary and legislative committees on matters concerning Indigenous child and family welfare. I met Ken 6 years ago at the downtown Toronto building, where we sat down this week together to look back on his life. The Ken that I have come to know is thoughtful, intelligent, and yes, perhaps a bit rough around the edges, perhaps a bit forceful, but always learning and always open-minded, and like the agency he so long has represented, a work in progress. He also has a rock and roll soul. I can attest to that. It was a pleasure to spend an hour with him in his new office, where he's now launching the Indigenous Spirit Foundation. So, without further ado, I give you Ken Richard. I interview a lot of people, and you get known for something. You establish a reputation. And I found that when I did these introductions, I started to ask people, you know, how would you like to be introduced? And I found a lot of times people get known for something and they didn't necessarily have a role in that. So, for instance, I remember I interviewed Phil Fontaine and I mentioned the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement, and he kind of rolled his eyes a little bit. He says, you know, I've done a lot of things. Everywhere I go, it's Indian Residential School Settlement this and Indian Residential School Settlement that. And he wanted to be remembered and known for a lot of things. So if I were to introduce you, I'd talk about you're the founding executive director of Native Child Family Services of Toronto, born in Winnipeg, Métis guy. I mean, we could go through that, but how is there a version of that for you, something you'd like to be known for, something you've done you're proud of that maybe doesn't get talked about?
Well, yes. I totally understand what Phil Fontaine would be saying. He would be a good example of, you know, being typecast and pigeonholed when you live larger than that and see the world not necessarily through those singular lenses. I'm very much like that. I see myself as, certainly in certain ways, as primarily an activist on children's rights, Indigenous children's rights. It's been my focus of my my professional life. It's been where I've lived in terms of most of my employment since the 70s. So that obviously colors my identity dramatically. But, you know, I've also been a roofer and a shoemaker, actually. Anybody remembers Hush Puppies? I worked in the last room and grabbed shoes. I pipeline construction, and what I really like to be known as is a not quite a failed musician, more of a successful musician that I got out of the game. I was with some very popular bands, one particularly in Winnipeg way back in the day, and So I see myself as a drummer, actually, and not a traditional drummer, but a trap artist, a stick man, if you will, still, and occasionally beat the skins for some special events and such. And I really identify with that. Whenever I speak to musicians, I speak to them as a musician, not as a child activist. So, you know, all of us who live these complicated lives has, I think, the capacity to switch on and off and to integrate all that stuff into one. So, yeah. But child activism, indigenous child, you know, this is, again, where I've lived and where I quite proudly don't mind being publicly identified.
Now, yesterday I was here, and by the way, I should mention, we're having this conversation at 30 College, downtown Toronto, so you're going to hear the street behind us.
Yes, it's as close to the urban reality as you can get.
That's right. And yeah. Just last night...
Little piece of Indian country in the middle of Toronto, though.
That's true. That's exactly true.
What we really strived for was to raise that red flag here.
Yeah, and we're going to go back and we're going to talk about the origins of this, because it seems like a kind of retrospective is appropriate. Last night we were here, and how would you characterize it? It was a, sort of an honoring ceremony, a gathering to look back on your life and to formally acknowledge your work and your contributions. So you must have been very much in a kind of, I wouldn't say nostalgic, but it was a time for looking back. You told a few stories at the end there about growing up in Winnipeg.
Yes, my bounty hunter father.
Well, you said two things. You said a number of things, but two really stuck with me. One is that your parents taught you about the importance of hard work. And at some point, you made a comment about how, you know, nowadays kids would have been taken from their families for living the way that you were living. You talked about...
Well, three kids in an unfurnished basement sleeping beside a coal fire would not be tolerated today.
But you wouldn't say that you had any... Certainly didn't have deprivations. And I think the way you put it is, we didn't live large, but we lived well enough.
Absolutely. Within the confines of certain times, the 50s were not an easy time in the 60s to be a child. The 50s were a fairly brutal time. We had a whole legions of returned servicemen traumatized by horrific experiences in the Second World War who were just kind of let go to marry their childhood sweetheart and pretend everything's okay. I think the 50s were pretty brutal for relationships in childhood because of unhealed trauma on the part of a large sector of the male population. And my father was part of that.
Yeah.
So that colored my world. Occasional bouts of economic anxiety during seasonal times when my dad would have been laid off, those sorts of things. Yeah, but overall, life is full of difficulties and opportunities. And I would say that by today's standards, I would not have been able to be in that family. We had some addiction issues as well. And, man, oh, man, that would have been terrible for me, as it has been for multitudes of children, particularly indigenous children.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I'm guessing it isn't anything that would be exceptional in the sense that a lot of certainly indigenous people know about the kinds of things that you'd be talking about.
Well, any indigenous person is going to be able to state a story within their family.
Yeah,
if not their own story related to child welfare.
But then there is the particularities of growing up in like the 60s and 70s. Right. You're in Winnipeg, which even today can be kind of a rough place.
Yeah.
And, when did we meet? We met, I think, about 6 years ago. And I've heard lots of stories about the Ken Richard back in the day. Kind of wish I had known you, but maybe I don't know if I
was a fun guy.
You were a fun guy.
Yeah. Went to the edge.
So you used the terms integration and complexity, and those are good terms because I feel there's both of those. I feel that at some point there were two Ken Richards that came together because you were the kind of had the long hair, and I'm wondering if it was rock and roll long hair or sort of indigenous power long hair or both.
It was both, yeah.
Probably,
yeah,
right?
Sure. And
you're a rock and roll guy,
but it
by
was
the
more
way.
Rock and roll than anything else, I'd say. the tail end, it takes a while to grow that length of hair, so I started that in the 70s, and it went into the 80s. That's a picture from, I think, actually I was his father then, so from the early 90s, but took a while. Long hair. No, it was cool.
Because you cut quite an image. I remember my earliest memories of you had the leather jacket.
Yeah, I ride a Harley Davidson. I've got all the cliches going here. You know, this guy's overreaching, maybe overthinking the role of being a party guy.
Yeah.
So, the rock and roll, the motorcycles, the, you know, that lifestyle was, it always was truly the death of me. And it took...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean...
You mean literally?
Well, literally in terms of drugs, absolutely. We've tripped into a whole other world. But I'm just thinking about, you know... that final image of the long-haired guy in the 90s, it came from some influences that were pretty rough, you know, back in the day. And this whole hippie stuff is, it's poorly remembered. It was not just love and peace. It was really extensive drug dependence and at times addictions, triggering lots of for vulnerable people, almost I had some friends that had psychotic episodes related to psychedelic drugs, so I saw all of that, and I'm just grateful that I was able to just emerge from all that, that I had enough resilience built into me, or strength, or whatever, to emerge from that, and present that kind of simple image of a long-haired guy in a... But I've had friends, I had a friend in Vancouver, and that showed me kind of these scars on his chest that were circular. And I'm going, how do you get that? He said, well, somebody jamming a shotgun in my chest as they demanded money from me for a bad drug deal. I'm going, you know, when you look at that stuff, you better exit pretty quickly or it's all going to be over. And you know what? We're dealing with all that again with the opioids and the fentanyl.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It's worse now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, everywhere I'm going, I'm hearing about that right now. And that, and of course, medical marijuana, but that's another issue.
Bring it on. Bring on the marijuana. Well, no. We've lived this stupid life for so long of...
Well, I wasn't making a parallel there. Okay? Yeah. Those are just two things that are happening.
Yeah. I know. I'm saying I'm looking forward to the 17th or whenever it is.
Yeah.
I forgot.
So I'm going to do a bit of a segue, but I'll set it up this way. So you know what your reputation is, and people who don't know you,
it was like a thing.
It was almost like a shtick last night. It's like, oh, you know, here's another story about...
Yeah, I'm a character.
Loudmouth, foulmouth, Ken says what he thinks, calls it as he sees it, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of stuff. Now, when I met you... My sense of you was that was kind of a two-dimensional thing, and people, I like that, and I think it has a kind of charm to it, but I found you kind of hard to read, and my sense was that kind of, and this is why I started talking about Phil, how you get a reputation that maybe you don't want, or that you don't feel really captures who you are. But I do feel like that kind of, it's almost becomes a character at some point.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I know you have a lot of depth to you.
Yeah, no kidding. And I'm not, and in fact, there's a lot of myths. You know, we choose our characters and weave myths around them because they're in leadership positions or whatever, so.
You wouldn't have gotten here and you wouldn't have been able to do your work if you didn't have some iron in you. But people
when I talked about hard work, I had no problem working. To me makes life meaningful. It's... We all know, some of us don't really understand. I understood, maybe worked a little too hard at times, and I paid some prices for it, but it was about hard work. But it was about, you know, I hate to be maudlin, but it was about, like, I can't stand to see unfairness.
Yeah.
I don't like to, I can't tolerate people being mean to people. Although it's interesting, people would say, well, Ken, you're always mad. But you know what? I may be mad, but I'm never cruel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm never lose sense of what justice is, what the right thing to do is. And I like to think I always do the right thing. And in that world of child welfare, and particularly with Indigenous children, it's important to have leadership that understand all that and have the transparency, which I am, mm-hmm. which is seeing, people say, what you see is what you get. Ken speaks his mind. This is the really important elements of working in a tough environment that has a lot of potential to go south, and the consequences of going south can be devastating. Children can die. You know full well about that story.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
At some point, I should probably do a disclosure here that we have worked together. Yeah. We've had a professional, still have a professional relationship. But here's where I was going with that. So you said last night towards, I think at the end of the speech you gave, when you say to people what you do, you tell them what you do and
they pity me.
They say, oh, that's too bad. That must be really mm-hmm. awful. And you're right. I mean, I think that is the association in a lot of minds. I mean, I find myself thinking that. Yeah, how do people do that job? Yeah. And, you know, let's be candid, Ken. When you do this work, there are people who are not fans of you for that. Or, tons of them.
Yeah.
But you offered a very different perspective on that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Well, you have to separate the mission from the systems that have been built to serve that mission. So,
well, that's easier said than done.
Well, of course.
But anyways.
But the mission to me is clear and non-negotiable. We measure the quality of our lives, I think, based on the quality of the children that we are responsible for, whether they're our own children or our collective children, and that's unequivocal, and that's actually a universal. There wouldn't be a single entity in this world that wouldn't agree with something like that, because it's so conducive to the continuation of our realities that, you know, we're not, children are our future. There's so many cliches, seventh generations into the future. The production of cared for and secure children is critical. Our children have not been well cared for and security, and that issue has not substantially changed in many years, although things are better than they've ever been, I must say. You know, having done child protection in Winnipeg in the 70s, I don't think we'd tolerate anymore what we were seeing there at that time. But there's a purity to that allows me to go with that purity. I can be pretty critical with respect to the systems that are the human systems put in place. And the child welfare system is a great example of how a clean mission can get sullied, more than sullied, that can get so distorted as to do the very opposite of what it's intended to do. And it's a great study in humans and their efforts to do the right thing, because it failed miserably. And, you know, I was in the day with the Children's Aid of Winnipeg, and you know, I never met a single social worker that said, I want to go and take those native kids. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just a thoughtless process.
Yeah.
Where people had given up critical analysis associated with doing the right thing and social justice. They abandoned all that. And I think people were pretty shocked at what they were looking at, because some of the conditions of the kids then, this is the time of rapid urbanization where a lot of people, one generation they were like living on the land, the next generation they're in downtown Winnipeg. Okay. You know, that's a pretty big leap. You know, Europeans, it took them a few hundred years to manage that one. Here we are with these, and these families fell apart. Alcohol destroyed them, and there was the Children's Aid. So, you know, I cut my teeth on that reality. We used to go to the parking lots in 40 below weather to make sure kids weren't abandoned in cars while the parents were in what we called the beer parlor back then. We used to break windows to get at kids. You know, I've done that 4 or 5 times. So, So that inspires you to say, you know, all this, is it really doing much to address the fundamentals here? And it isn't. So I've been on that campaign to do child welfare better. And so that mission is clean, and it gives me title to, I think, because I've signed on to it for so long, to be critical, which is what I am. And that's what people sometimes read. They say, oh, Ken, he's mad. Well, he's not really mad.
You could be forgiven for being mad about a lot of things.
I mean, somebody's got to be mad. You know, because there's lots to be mad about.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm trying to lead the way. Passion's important.
So when you get to this point, because you have the benefit of some years, but your point's well taken. And I think when you get to this point, is it possible to have some perspective there? You can say, I mean, you've suggested that things are a lot better or better than they were.
And 99% of the time, the state should not remove children from their homes, pretty much.
Yeah.
I would say that's a rare, it was a matter of course for many years, for many child welfare systems to simply remove children as their primary service. That's exactly the wrong way to look at it. Family, and this is cliche now, family preservation, because that's not so easy when you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a parent that is nodding off on a narcotic trip every day, leaving a child in a crib, I can show you pictures that you would not be able to look at them. And you've seen some based on our previous work. You should see some of the pictures of neglect when families get so involved in the drug addlement that they forget they have children. They forget that they should go to the bathroom in a toilet. I've seen all that. And that's where you intervene. That is very rare.
Yeah.
You know, it's mostly a depressed mom, maybe occasionally doing drugs, being often very much a victim of assault herself and neglect by a state and assault by a predacious boyfriend. It's tough.
So I don't think there are many people who at least don't have some sense that's the reality, right? But what people probably don't understand is sort of the perspective that you have as somebody who's, been working on this. Because I hear everyone singing from the same hymn book, which is that, there's two things I hear all the time. One is that we want to be in control of our own systems that we design. And the second is we want to go from protection to prevention.
Yes.
And get out of the whole removing children sort of approach.
That's been the
It's mantra. Been a while now that I've, I mean, I guess that's a long-term thing.
Yeah. Well, it is, and only lately, actually, has there been actual movement on making that a reality through, and let's face it, these services cost money. Shifting from the protection function, which is very expensive. Some of the per diems, the per-day payments to institutions, group homes and foster homes can be eye-popping. And sometimes that's highly warranted. You have a child with medical needs, for example, that needs a G-tube, we call it, because the reflex is not there for swallowing. These are kids in tremendous jeopardy. They cost $400, $500, $600, maybe sometimes $800 a day. Okay, that's the price you pay. Now, there's a lot of children who need good, loving homes. And they are in similar kinds of payment situations. So you've got a very bizarre scenario where there's a lot of profit-making and private sector and entrepreneurship that see children as a commodity. So, and it's not very well regulated. Every time they look at it, they get alarmed because kids are in jeopardy often and not being well served. So it's a system that is broke anyway, this bringing the kids into care. Why don't we invest that $500 a day in the family? Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Well, you can imagine
with
the good
some,
and the bad. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, because when somebody's got addictions, giving them money might not be the right thing without a kind of supportive counseling and such. But this is another thing I've learned. I'll say that I think most of these problems that people are bringing to child welfare and such relate to the stresses inherent in living a poverty lifestyle with unresolved trauma in a marginalized world. Okay. They have found, and this is why this current government in Ontario seems cruel and foolish in its own way, that giving people money, giving poor people money, is the best way of dealing with issues in child and family life. Now, it's bizarre, but they say $10,000 to a family is equivalent, for example, to another year of high school for the kids.
Hmm.
Okay, that stuff is verifiable in the researches.
Yeah.
So why aren't we? We have a nice little pilot program. I think it's across the province in different smaller towns, where we are augmenting as taxpayers people's income, ensuring that they have enough to pay the rent and live a normal life.
Yeah.
This government is in the middle of it, is killing the program. So we won't be able to benefit from the research that would have come from it that might have gotten us to some of the structural issues. So I've got the government saying, whatever they're saying in terms of a rationale, I think it's too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've learned this, as I said, more money to poor people seems to work a lot better than endless counseling.
Sure. I mean,
can be needed, is needed often. But the fundamentals are your capacity. And it's not just about the money. It's about control of your life. You can pay your landlord so he's not on your case and threatening you and the child's picking up all this tension and they're hypervigilant and they can't learn. And, it's a very complex set of dynamics that play themselves out when you're economically insecure and have food insecurity. But a lot of it leads to the attention of the child welfare authorities. Sometimes because of parental behavior, they lose it a lot. Child behavior, they're nutritionally challenged or whatever. They're not getting the services they need anyway.
But the underlying stuff is pretty basic. It's money, food security,
it's
sort of thing.
Security.
Security.
People look at quite a bit of security. In this
world. We realize that, people say, the problem is drugs. Well, I realized at some point, no, drugs are the solution. They're not a good solution, but people turn to that when they're in pain, when, there's no hope. You feel like you have no control of your life. You just numb yourself. You medicate yourself, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've been in a, I don't want to say an enviable position, but we can all say this is what we think. But you actually have been somebody who has had an opportunity to sit in your chair at a committee, at a parliamentary session.
Oh, yeah. I talked to
you're a go-to guy.
Not so long ago.
Yeah. What do you tell these guys? What kind of stuff goes on in these rooms?
Well, you only have moments, so you have to choose your words carefully.
After you've grabbed them by the throat.
It's surprising how timid I am, actually, in the face of higher authority. But, the Jesuits taught me well, I think.
What did they used to say? Give me the child by seven and we'll have them for life.
That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But you are a firm.
Here's what I know.
You're the expert. Whether you like it or not.
Yes, I am.
You're seen that way.
But I'm also reminded of that little joke that an expert is anybody more than 50 miles from home. So, I'm well over that. So here I am spouting away. But I have had opportunity to meet with, a lot of the power brokers in the political arena out there. I actually had Lisa McLeod here, our new minister for these services, attend here.
What was that like?
She was delightful.
Yeah.
She's a farm girl.
Yeah.
She's a hugger.
Okay.
She loves hockey and Big Brothers.
Yeah. So you got along well?
Well, we got along well, but I think we're not going to get along forever. Because she, for example, is defending the cut to that fiscal support program, giving poor people money. So, I'm afraid that her ministry, along with every other ministry, is going to be subservient to the other agenda, which is really to save the taxpayers' money, that mantra.
Right.
So, yeah.
You know what they used to say about the Harris government? Harris knew the cost of everything and the value of nothing.
I would say that I'm going to let,
I'm not putting words in your mouth.
Even more forceful.
But,
references coming. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's a whole program, I think.
Now, you're not Ken Richard, Executive Director of Native Child and Family Services of Toronto anymore.
No.
So you can take off that hat. You're an advisor. You're still working in some capacity.
I have many, many titles. Yeah. I'm shape-shifting.
Do you want to talk about all the things you're doing?
Sure, I'll talk about, yes, I have three jobs. advisor to the incoming executive director, and that's for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly complex organization. He's new to the province.
Oh, really?
John,
okay.
So he welcomes support from me, thankfully, and I'll be doing that for a while.
I'd be curious to know what your...
I will carry a few more projects for the agency for a while on a part-time basis, related to folios that I am kind of elected to based on me, not the agency, but serving the agency. And that way I sit on the local advisory council for the local health integration network and those sorts of things. So I'll continue that kind of technical stuff, a little bit of that. I'm on a couple of boards. I'm on, you know, the Child Welfare League of Canada, trying to get them, trying to assist them in becoming a little more sensitive to Indigenous issues. And I mean, they represent a coalition of mainstream agencies, and, you know, I try to be helpful with them, sit on their task force on Aboriginal issues, so that kind of stuff. But my big mission is the establishment of the Indigenous Spirit Foundation, which is, as you know, we've spoken about it before, a foundation that is going to emerge to challenge, it's emerging now to challenge in a good way, helpful way, you know, the current reality that there's a huge disconnect between corporate Canada and Indigenous children. You know, all the studies that, there's virtually few studies, but the Circle for Philanthropy, for example, out of Ottawa, did a report a few years ago now, but I'm sure it hasn't changed much, showing 3% of the corporate dollar reaching Aboriginal people. And that was mostly through particular sponsorships related to this one daycare sponsored by a mining company or something. I want to go at it a little more structurally. We're well positioned here in Toronto. But the money's flying around here. Everybody's rich here now. Everybody's house is $1 million. So with that kind of reality, I think, some would say I'm an opportunist. But it's all for the cause, and we hope to start making connections between Indigenous children and corporate Canada in the form of services and funding related to their giving. There's a few players out there that I'm trying to knock on their doors and get them a little more sensitive to the issues, and we're starting to do that. So it's exciting.
Yeah, building a foundation.
Absolutely. That's what I actually am best at. I'm not actually the world's best administrator.
You're going to go on record with that.
Oh, 100%. Whenever they review the agency, they find that he's honest. But I wish that he just paid more attention to things like credit card receipt. But you know, I can't keep track of everything that I have to. I'm a bit distracted at times, like many leaders are. You know, I always need a handler. You need handlers.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
You're all over the place and trying to do everything. You need people on your side.
Yeah. So. Well, that goes back to the 87, the agency started up here.
80, yeah. 80, well, we started 86? The discourse, because that's the new
yeah,
word,
sure.
In the mid-80s, actually.
Yeah.
When, you know, that was a time when there was the explosion of news stories related to dysfunction in the child welfare system.
Right.
There was some cases, Richard Cardinal, Alanis Abramson made a movie called Richard Cardinal, Diary of a Métis Child, all about the horrors of foster care and a child's eventual suicide within it. We had Calvin Curley, who was a kid from Cree boy from Manitoba on death row in Texas. For killing his adoptive father, who had been sexually abusing him for many years. We had the Kimmelman report called No to a Safer Place, I think it was called, which is, you know, all about stirring the great realization that child welfare sucked for Indigenous kids, and it was doing the opposite of what it should have done. So I was very much excited about, I just moved to Toronto, actually, in the early 80s and went, this doesn't feel like Winnipeg. You know, where's all the, you know, all the Indigenous people?
Because
I stumbled upon one guy, Gus Ashawaski, and he says to me, you have a degree in social work? You're, come and be the ED.
Wow.
It was like that. It took a while, but eventually I did all of that. And
so that door just kind of opened up. You weren't knocking on it necessarily.
There's a whole cadre of unsung Indigenous heroes out there. So,
well, you can sing if you want.
Yeah. Yes,
no, I mean,
well,
shout outs are welcome.
Last night, because you know, when you think about Indigenous heroes, everybody puts them way back in the day, right?
Yeah.
You know, Tom Longboat would be recent. Is more likely to be Tecumseh, right? So it's good to spell. I try to speak their names. You know, is what the teaching is.
Yeah.
Speak the names of those who you know need to be recognized. And so whenever I make comments, I draw Indigenous protocols are all about giving away the glory, and I'm happy to do that.
Yeah. And now you go back to that time, and I mean the idea of they wouldn't say Indigenous back then, but the idea of an Indigenous
we
agency.
We had no problem saying, you know, other words.
Yeah. I mean, that was not a mainstream idea. That was not a welcome idea. Let's start a Native agency.
Yeah.
Right?
It wasn't welcome in the in the mainstream. No, there was a lot of anxiety, and we were one of the early players in that. So, oh yeah, it was a struggle. We had to take them to court, or we had to create a court case, present them with that case, and have them come to the table based on that the threat for a class action. Yeah,
some things never change.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So
we're still in court.
Indeed, the lawyer who created the case for us is the very lawyer that was part of this that led the 60 Scoop Challenge.
Oh, okay.
So Jeff Wilson, who happens to be a friend of mine, fellow biker, blah blah blah. So there's lots of connections.
I was going to say issues. You seem to stay connected to people for a long time.
Well, those who burn with the issue, and I'm privileged to know these great people like Jeff Wilson and Cindy Blackstock, who everybody is. Is well aware of her work. But there's many other unsung people. Like Raymond Shingoos for the Yorkton Tribal Council. I don't know how well known he would be, but I know Raymond is a guy who comes from a very strong and traditional place, speaks his language, and is really trying to turn the tides in a very difficult environment in that part of Saskatchewan. So, you know, there's heroes everywhere, and they don't get much recognition. Sometimes I think my recognition comes primarily from my location. I'm easy to find, right here in Yonge Street. The CBC, TVO, all these people come to us sometimes because we're damn convenient. But, if you go out into, the more far reaches, there's people that work and that are creating wonderful things, and they never get recognized. So, only when somebody commits suicide.
Sure.
That's still the perception. They don't, it's almost like, well, they don't want good stories, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well,
I mean,
when
everything's great, nobody notices.
A good story will confuse the public. We don't want to say there's health in the community because it takes away from the issue of suicide. But we got to stop doing that. We should. Who said this? Show the things that glitter.
Yeah.
Show the balance.
You're at an age now. A lot of people. I think that point was made. Somebody else made it, and. A lot of people retiring. There's a new generation coming along,
is.
Younger people. I don't know what you say to the young people or your successor.
The young people, yes.
Seemed like a young fellow to me.
Yes. Yeah, the guy's 37. I'm going, what? No, he's a smart guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I hope so.
I hope so, yes.
We hired this guy. He's a dummy.
Yeah. Well, I'm just affirming that, sometimes you hire thinking it's smart and then you realize it's not. But he's proven to be clever throughout so far, and it's been a few months, so.
Well, that'll come in handy. It will be necessary. But, I mean, what's he facing? It's a different world, isn't it? Or is it? Am I off base there?
He's facing, I think right now the political climate is a very bizarre one, because we have, we have on one hand, a seemingly regressive provincial government with a singular focus, which is not going to be prioritizing Indigenous issues. I don't think, do we ever come up anymore? I'm not even sure. But we come up a lot now, though, at the federal level. INAC is now, through the Jordan's principle, through the class action suit on the 60 Scoop, in a position of, by law, investing, where they wouldn't before. So they are... I don't want to say tossing money around like drunken sailors, but they're spending money without a clear policy framework.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you that. I think Jane Philpott, and I want to give her credit for, stepping up. But I think she has stepped up in a world of, and created a world of confusion a little bit, because there's quite a bit of money at play and vague policy. So it's, but you know, with chaos comes opportunity. Mm-hmm. And this is where people like me come in. You find the pathways within, yeah, you know, the difficult scenario.
And, you are an optimist.
Well, because we've been successful. We were successful with the Harris government.
Yeah, no, I think that's important.
We, you know,
recognize.
We will, you know, we'll adjust within reason to political realities and take advantage where we can. Or sometimes we just say, okay, let's just defend for the moment what we have instead of trying to grow. That might be where we're going now. I think it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's going to be much innovation coming out of this government. But, you know, this agency's done very well. It's
Yeah, you've been through all kinds of governments.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I must say that each government has its challenges, and each government has also its opportunities. So that's the maturity that comes from, I think, working with successive governments. This is something that the younger emerging generation may not be so aware of. But you know what? Maybe they shouldn't be aware of it, because maybe that would compromise, you know, their potential for discovery of other things, of other ways, of other understanding. So I just try to be there to make sure. I'm saying to him, in my advisory capacity, Jeff, there's no plan B. You're the guy, and we're going to make it work. So we're doing that. Notwithstanding, you know, the challenges, and they're complex here. Not only is this a complicated agency, yeah, it also is a complicated environment, and it's going to take a... I call it a steely eye and a steady hand, you know. Don't overplay the card, but always show up, you know.
Yeah.
And I you know, it's how you learn these things in life. I'll tell you, one of the great lessons I had, for example, in working in the indigenous issues was... a naive young social worker at some kind of social planning meeting that said, naively, gee, Ken, we never talked about Native people when you're not around. So when I heard that, I said, my God, I'll have to be in every room every day to get the agenda going. And so that's what I did.
Yeah, excellent.
So that's the kind of work that has been and always will be the important part of these jobs. Is to show up. And when I get back to that thing about hard work, that's what it is. It's continuous, even though... And so I'm happy to pass that kind of stuff along, because that's... If there's something called wisdom, it would be chill up. Well, there was a... I heard a Cree guy, an elder, say, you know, stand up and look around, was his message. And you're going, what does that mean? And I thought, kept thinking about it. And it meant... showing up,
yeah,
and seeing, and what he meant is, how can you help?
Yeah,
you know, that's what you do.
Yeah, now you're not going off into the woods.
No,
well, you probably will go off once in a while into the woods.
I'm going off into the.
You're a canoer, right?
You know, I gotta get back to my birds.
Your birds, yeah.
Yeah, man. I am Ornithology 101 right now.
Really?
Have a house on the flyway, basically.
So you're one of those guys who you can tell all the different bird songs, and you're like...
but I can tell you what a rose-breasted nuthatch looks like.
Oh, okay.
Or the difference between a pelated and a downy woodpecker.
Ah.
And, you know, yeah. And so, yeah, I tender swans... Oh, my God, my resident heron, I am in paradise.
Yeah.
Where I live, because I've got the best of the Canadian reality. I've got a downtown Toronto life and a Crow River Valley life, which is halfway between Peterborough and Ottawa, and what they call what Al Purdy, Canada's poet, called the country of my disappointment. What he meant by that was the farming sucked.
Oh, yeah.
And where the farming sucked, the birds and everything else enjoy. So I'm on a lovely stretch of river, and it's a flyway going north and south depending on the season. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time looking at the birds, you know.
Yeah. It sounds like a good life. And when you're not doing that, you're on your motorcycle out there riding around.
Yes, I just got back from Arkansas not too long ago. Went down to the Ozarks there. You know, hung out with bikers a little bit. Yeah. Had some pretty good barbecue. And, you know, here's the deal. You know, I remember one of the most helpful guys on that trip was a one-legged old man, Bob. Even by my standards, who still rode his Dinah Harley, and was a Trump supporter, absolutely. One of the nicest and unequivocal in his allegiance to that guy. And one of the nicest and most helpful people you're going to want to meet was this guy. His name was Fish, he called himself. Anyway, so traveling on a Harley, you come up to, you know, these realities, and the confusion that is, because you want to, of course, make life simple and say anybody that supports Trump is not a nice person, is an ignorant person. He was none of that. So that's what I like about traveling on the motorcycle. Mm-hmm. It brings people together like that, bikers particularly, but almost everybody has no problem going up to a motorcycle guy and saying, hey, I had a bike. Almost everybody tells me they had a bike, whether they had one or not. And I'm good with that. And then, of course, they start telling me about their horrific accidents. And I say, you know, I don't really talk about accidents. I mean, I know what they're all about. I've spent endless hours watching YouTube videos of motorcycle accidents. And you can see them. Oh, yeah, just Google it.
No, that's okay.
Well, you know, you learn a lot. 90% of the time, speed. You're going too fast,
going
my
too
friend.
Fast. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not somebody hitting you, as everybody says. It's you hitting something because you lose control. Anyway, I digress.
That's an important point. All you kids listening.
Yeah, well, it is true.
Slow down.
90% of accidents in motorcycles can be mitigated by turning down, you know, easing off on the throttle, truly. But, and then there's the beaver that crosses the road at twilight.
When we went back in our time machine to when you were first setting up Native Child and Family Services of Toronto, I guess we did talk about, you know, what things were like back then, what the environment was like back then. But kind of what were the aspirations? Where did you see where you wanted to go? And how do you feel now that you, where you were able to get?
Well, the aspiration was and, you know, it's embodied actually in our mission statement, which is displayed on the wall on the other side here. But it was to create an agency that serve to enhance child and family life and to use culture and the focus on our collective parenting responsibilities, the extended family. And it was all about addressing the issue of Indigenous children in a much more positive, strength-based way. So it was all those lofty ideas that still exist. We have been successful in some areas and absolutely unsuccessful in others. The maintenance of the changing the experience of child welfare for Indigenous children in Toronto is changed. It was brutal. It was the Catholic Children's Aid. It was apprehension. It was the 60s scoop writ large. Toronto was not exempt from the rest of the country, and so that's gone. Kids do not no longer disappear, because they disappeared. They were just gone. They had their names changed. They're in Massachusetts, and some of them are there still and have no clue about who they are, other than that they were adopted. No adoptions, no disappearing, no, none of that. That being said, have we altered the fundamental condition of Indigenous children through our work? On a case-by-case basis, we've absolutely improved the lives of some kids, but the structural issues at play, the poverty, the addictions, in fact, things are worse to some extent than they have been.
I remember when I did this with Cindy Blackstock, she told me that there are more children in the system now than there were at the height of the residential schools. I found that shocking.
Yes. Well, it is shocking, but let me spin that a little bit.
Okay.
Because it's probably worse, better than you think. And what I mean by that is while kids may be in care, many are now in care within their own communities. Many indeed are in care of their kinship relations, aunties and uncles and grannies and such. So things are better. The numbers of kids who are designated as wards of the state is, yeah, greater. Is I don't know what it is.
60, yeah, 000, I didn't see a number 60, of it.
60,000 right now in care, yeah, maybe 80,000. Yeah, yeah, and over time, it'd be a huge job population, and Cindy's not wrong on that. There's also a lot more Indigenous children now, and so proportionally. So, you know, we have to see these stats. They're great. I use those stats, too. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, they're important
stats, yep. And they're banner headlines, and they should be read. But analysis shows a complicated set of variables. Some of it's actually good information, the information that makes you feel better with respect to the quality of the work. So my experience as a younger social worker was not to apprehend, but, you know, I sometimes wonder the condition of some of those kids, what I could do. You know, that being said, I worked on it and mostly had much better results without apprehending. So I carried that. And it certainly went into this mission. And so this agency is shaped by Indigenous children from Winnipeg, from the 70s. Because that's my experience that I brought here.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So have I, things are way better than they were. Yes. They need help. Mm-hmm. We have just been in existence for 20-odd years, 30-odd years. So. Yeah. The first Children's Aid Society in Ontario was established in 1889 or 91 or...
Anyway, a few years ago, yeah.
Well over 100 years ago. We've been at it 20 years, so
yeah.
I think we're going to develop a system that is going to be really good, although it's hard.
I mean, in an ideal world, you would be doing something else for a living. I guess, or the work would be a lot different.
Human condition,
and that's where it's going to go, right? I mean, this agency will evolve, and you'll be focusing more on.
Yes, absolutely. It will become, hopefully, what it is meant to be. You know, we gave it it's certainly its first 25 years. I did. Now let's see where it goes for the next. You know, I'm very optimistic. I tell you, we did some things right. We have this building. Which is, and we have
great. It's a great building. It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, and it's not just that it's a beautiful building, though, as you know. We have, when I first walked into Toronto, and Winnipeg wasn't much better, all the Indigenous agencies were in basements.
Yeah.
In church halls.
Yep, that's right.
That's true. Soup and clothing. Millie Redmond at Council Fire and everything. And that was what was needed then. And God bless her. She's gone. Long gone, but Order of Canada, what a tough cookie she was. And that was the world. And so there at the largesse of the churches, and, you know, we were able to, through progressive people on my board, to establish, you know, long-range planning associated with higher-level issues. Urbanization is rampant, whether we like it or not. The Indigenous child typically lives in the city now. That will become more reality later. If you do not have public institutions to serve the needs of those kids, they will easily be absorbed in a city like Toronto into this kind of F-class stuff, this brown population that, you know, might be oppressed, might not, becomes more of a class issue then. But if we want the maintenance of Indigenous Canada, we better build the city infrastructure to be able to receive people. And part of it is owning some property. Because we know on a spiritual level the importance of land. Mm-hmm. But in a city like Toronto, it's very practical. If you're a tenant here, you live a life of misery. If you're an owner, you're privileged. Mm-hmm. So we in terms of the commercial space,
yep.
Right? We were evicted half the time, and we couldn't smudge, couldn't drum, couldn't, you know. So, you know, the Creator was smiling on us when these opportunities, and I'm quite aggressive on that. They say, you know, drop a nickel and Ken will fight you for it, crawl to it, and, you know, hold on to it from his dead cold fingers. You will try that nickel. So, So I think I'm a very convoluted way answering your question about have we achieved. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
And we've achieved a lot. We have the bonds. We have the physical bonds. We have legal agreements that will continue funding our work. We have the physical plants. We own most of our properties. We own about $50 million worth of property.
Well, you've got something that a lot of folks don't have, which is some, you know, assurance that you can keep this going. It's sustainable is one of the words that people kick around.
Well, too big to fail applies not only to Lehman Brothers. Was it Lehman Brothers or Wells Fargo?
But that's fair to say, right? I mean, you are secure. You have some security there.
And people are grateful that we're there. Believe me, the Catholic Children's Aid does no longer want to serve indigenous people.
Yeah.
These files are difficult and expensive files to serve. They're quite content to give over. So we're here, and we'll be here. And, you know, it's a huge leap. And Toronto, actually, I think, was one of the most progressive cities in the country in terms of movement to self-control, to control of institutions.
Yeah.
We have legal clinics. We've, you know, other cities have certainly caught up, but we've been, I hate to play the Toronto card here and, you know, be all egocentric and everything, but we've done very well.
Yep. Yeah. So the next big thing, I guess, is really the systemic stuff.
Yeah. Well, it is the big thing. It's always the big thing.
It's always the big thing.
Measuring yourself with respect to systemic change. Listen to that kid. Great lungs, eh? That's my reality.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what was the question?
That's okay.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. Is there anything on your mind we haven't talked about? Anything bugging you?
My mantra now is, you know, I want to see the behavior side of reconciliation.
Oh, gosh. Reconciliation, you know, that's a loaded word now.
Well, no, I don't want to. Indeed, many of us don't even want to use the R word, but you know what? It's the only thing that grabs the attention of many people. So what I'm saying now, and as I struggle through all these painful acknowledgments that people are given prior to their whatever they're doing, I go, okay, the acknowledgement is, you know, we're at that now, 8 years now of acknowledgements. I want to see some movement around that wheel to the behavioral part.
Some action.
The action part, and that's a struggle.
Yeah.
So that's on my mind is how to craft within this moment of opportunity. And I think it's all the window's already closing in some ways, but that's okay. I've lived through everything. How do we get people to behave differently?
Yeah. No, that's definitely where it should go.
In a good way, and not forced to by court, by, you know, settlements and payouts and all that stuff, but willingly, because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
That's the challenge for Canadians.
Yeah. Are you involved in any kind of stuff around that at all, or any...
Around what?
Reconciliation and all that.
Well, we did actually a reconciliation process at this agency. We were asked our clients how we were doing, and they... Yeah. Well, they did a couple of things. They said, you're doing pretty good in some ways and really terribly in others, and we had to craft their client bill of rights, and we did a lot of accountability.
That's right.
Related to that. So we've done our personal reconciliation. And what we were doing actually is reconciling not our behaviors much as those who have come before us.
Yeah.
But that's okay. Somebody had to do it.
Yeah.
So I am involved. And of course, you know, I have occasionally sat on committees and such and provided advice related to that. And I, you know, my mantra is a simplistic one. You have to do stuff.
You know, stuff.
Yeah. Well, every situation will demand a different set of behaviors, but there's got to be tangibility to it. It's got to involve the energies, including fiscal energy.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
This is what this Indigenous Spirit Foundation is going to be talking about, was the behavioral part of this relationship.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's fun to build things. I mean, that's...
It is fun. I'm a bit daunted, though. It feels like going to be a lot of work.
That never stopped you before.
So. No. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah.
Is that a good place to leave off there?
Probably.
I think so.
Now I'm all wondering. Do I have it for this? I probably do, because you know what? The more fire there is, the more fired up I get. So
I like it when you get fired up, Ken. Yeah. I like the fired up, Ken.
Some people were saying that. You know, a woman came up to me last night, and she held my hand, and she was almost weeping. And she said, you know, I was so scared of you. I was so scared of you. And I'm going, oh, why are you crying and holding my hand? Because she, at the end of it, she said, you taught me so much about your issues. And,
yeah,
you know, I guess it's the passion overwhelmed her that I might have expressed at the time. So it's really gratifying. And I had a woman outside the office, because I had this party last night, as you know, who I guess wasn't coming. She was a, quote, a client. And she came to me and she said, don't listen to all those people that call you down. If it wasn't for you guys, I wouldn't have been able to parent my child, who was now 15 years of age.
Yeah.
That the Children's Aid Society was coming to get him, and you intervened, and you preserved my family. She didn't quite put it.
I would have, honestly, Ken, I mean, I would have liked to have heard more of those people last night.
No, I know. You know,
but, well, you
that's
know,
such that's as those
whatever.
Go. But yeah. So, no, that was a really strong emotional experience last night. So, yeah, let's end this.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to weep now. No. Okay.
It's not the Barbara Walters show. No. I won't make you cry.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you for giving me your time, Ken.
Oh, my pleasure. Always.
Yeah.
You're a fun guy to talk to.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.